The verdict is in for El Chapo.
Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman.
When the U.S. really puts his mind to it, they can capture and bring somebody like Chapo to justice.
One of the world's most infamous gangsters.
This man is a ruthless, dangerous trafficker.
El Chapo had been in hiding since 2001.
Inflammatory testimony, bribery, murders, sort of how the Sinaloa cartel was formed back in the day.
There's a fear of him escaping.
He jumped out of bed without clothes on, tripped a secret switch that lifted up his bathtub, fled through basically the sewer system under the city and got away.
A federal jury here in the Eastern District convicted Joaquin El Chapo Guzman Loera.
Chapo Guzman has been convicted on all counts.
On all counts of the federal indictment.
En el juicio contra Joaquin El Chapo Guzman.
It is guilty on all counts for the notorious El Chapo.
After decades of evasion and escape and enough melodrama for 10 Netflix series, El Chapo stands convicted. The Mexican drug kingpin Joaquin El Chapo Guzman now faces life in prison, and that would be a supermax federal prison, not the kind of place you can tunnel out of. El Chapo's capture and conviction have been a priority in the Mexican war on drugs. Here's Richard Donahue, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, speaking on Tuesday following the guilty verdict.
This conviction is a victory for every family who has lost a loved one to the black hole of addiction. There are those who say that the war on drugs is not worth fighting. Those people are wrong.
But for many in Mexico, his capture and trial appear to be more of a charade.
It's a reflection of what happens in the Mexican society, but El Chapo's trial has not been as spectacular as it was thought in the United States. This probably will not affect anything in the country, unless the government has a will to go after the corrupt politicians.
That's Guadalupe Correa Cabrera. She's an associate professor in the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. Since the Mexican drug war was launched in 2006, over 200,000 people have died, more than 30,000 people have disappeared, and new criminal organizations have emerged. In 2008, the U.S. began providing weapons, training, and billions of dollars to Mexican security forces to fight organized crime. But the violence continues. 2018 saw more homicides in Mexico than any previous year, more than 33,000. I asked Guadalupe Carrera Cabrera whether we could be looking at a new chapter in the war on drugs following El Chapo's conviction.
Well, the verdict, we expected that. Mm-hmm. There are many things that were said about the Sinaloa cartel that might affect to some extent the investigations that can be done if there is political will to be done this by the Mexican authorities. However, you know, the spectacular statements and the spectacular stories are really not going to affect drug trafficking in the United States. It is not going to affect the position of the Sinaloa cartel in any major form. I mean, it's not the time of the narcos. Probably symbolically speaking, this is a symbol of the end of the times of the narcos, the narco era. And this is important because these organizations have become more sophisticated. The different segments of the supply chain are managed by different people. We're not talking about these vertical organizations that at some point existed in Mexico that were run by families, that were very, very vertical, and that if the head was wrong, something happened, or the kids take over, and it was a big fight for power. But that's really not what is happening now. And at the same time, we're dealing with organizations that respond to the demand for drugs. It's not about the supply side of things. And this is what we are right now focusing on. And this is what U.S. agencies are focusing on, because also this has to do with their budgets. And if they have, you know, if they have these targets all the time, the kingpin strategy is very good for like the Drug Enforcement Administration in the United States, because you will always have targets. You will always have kingpins to go after them. You generate more violence, so you have more to say about this. But in reality, drug addiction is not finished in the United States, and drugs continue coming in larger numbers.
Could you explain a bit for us the complexity of the landscape now of the drug war in Mexico? Because it's not just the Sinaloa cartel. Could you give us a sort of short sketch of how things have changed there?
One thing is something that the United States media or political commentators in the United States and also in Mexico forget that the problems in Mexico and the violence in Mexico is not exclusively drug related. And the organizations that we see that are highly armed and that are called drug cartels do not necessarily traffic drugs. What has happened with other groups in Mexico? Because of 12 years of a so-called drug war, which means the militarization of security strategy in Mexico, in the framework of the Mérida Initiative, this means in collaboration with the United States and a strategy that's based on many things, but one important element of that strategy has been to go after the kingpins, the kingpin strategy. That has caused a lot of fragmentation in some organizations. So you have a lot of groups right now operating in Mexico. Not all of them traffic drugs. Some of them dedicate to steal gasoline. The huachicoleo, the recent crisis of gasoline in Mexico has to do with that phenomenon. That's not only part of the drug cartel structures. It's, I mean, other criminal groups that are highly armed and have adopted this model. So there are a lot of cells now operating in different parts of the country. And this has caused a very high level of homicides. So last year was the year with the largest number of homicides. So this rate has come up instead of going down. But that is not necessarily as directed to drug trafficking. And we have to understand that these organizations have a lot of capacity of fire and they control territories. And this is why they fight for territories. But it's not only about drugs. So El Chapo Guzman, I mean, we're focusing here on El Chapo Guzman's trial and El Chapo Guzman's verdict. It's not going to change the panorama of organized crime in Mexico.
In the U.S., we tend to see the violence in Mexico just entirely through the lens of the drug war. Of those, you know, more than 30,000 murders last year, how much of that had to do with the drug trade?
This is an important question because we don't know. Officially, we don't know. There was an attempt to calculate that drug-related murders at some point or, you know, murders related to this phenomena. We don't have that number. We just have the absolute number of homicides. But as I say, you go after all these groups that are highly armed and commit extortion, kidnap people, and dedicate to other criminal activities. We really don't know how many of these homicides are related to drugs and the drug war in itself.
The capture and conviction of El Chapo reflects the kingpin strategy, as it's been called. It worked in as much as that Chapo will now be going to prison. But does it work, or what will work going forward from here as an approach?
I mean, we have an opioid crisis in the United States, right? People consume more drugs than ever, and billions of dollars have been spent on anti-narcotics cooperation with other countries in the Americas and the world. And this kingpin strategy has been repeated and multiplied in the past decades, and nothing has happened. Therefore, it's a failed strategy. The kingpin strategy is failed if we consider the objectives of the agencies like the DEA. If the agencies like the DEA have other goals, like just strategic control of the Americas, that is a good strategy. But if this is about drugs, if this is about less drugs arriving to the United States, it has totally failed. So therefore, we can think about the different strategies to deal with this issue that maybe have to do with the demand of drugs. Maybe dealing with this issue as a problem of public health would help more. This has been discussed forever. Many people have said that, but this seems to be about budgets. This seems to be about other strategic goals. This is probably the war on drugs. It's not about drugs itself. It's about other things. Let's think about it.
Well, in terms of that, of this newer phase of the drug war and with the opioid crisis and a lot of fentanyl coming from Mexico, what's going to be the right approach to deal with that? Or is that just going to keep coming, getting worse?
Then this mystification that all drugs come from the south, that they cross through the border, is just a myth. How much of the fentanyl that it's consuming the United States is really coming from China, crossing through the Mexican ports and going to the United States? I mean, in different fora related to this. And nobody has been able to answer the question, how much of the fentanyl that's consuming the United States comes from Mexico? There is the assumption that the majority of this, by some authorities and by some people who address this issue from the Mexican perspective, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is assumption that as if all the fentanyl, because the cocaine came from Mexico at some point, it's coming from Mexico. As you know, the fentanyl that comes from Asia is pure. It's much purer than the one that's produced in Mexico. So most of the materials that are utilized to produce fentanyl come from Asia. They can come from Canada. They can come from different parts. Why they should make their way through Mexico? This is the thing that we have to consider. I mean, the problem today, it's symptomatic of a very sick society. And there are other factors that are psychological, that are social, that might have been impacting this. It's about the demand. It's not about the supply. And we need to remember that. So with this, I mean, it can be fentanyl now, and tomorrow it can be cocaine again. And the day after that, it can be another drug. And the crisis are going to repeat. So many years of a war on drugs in the United States, and we are in the worst time of all. And there is like this obsession to continue with these and these trials, spending so much money to make this all so spectacular. The dogs, the people that are armed, the judges, and things are worse than ever. But as I said, maybe the objective of the DEA is not to protect its nation from drugs, but exercising strategic control on the Americans.
Guadalupe Carrera Cabrera is associate professor at George Mason University. Guadalupe, thank you.
Thank you, Arun, for this. Thank you for having me here. It has been a pleasure.
Are you feeling deja vu this week?
Safety is the birthright of every American, which is why we must finish the wall. It's happening. Smart, strategic, see-through, steel barrier or wall. Let's go to wall. But we need the wall, and it has to be built, and we want to build it fast.
Sources tell CNN that President Trump will sign off on a federal budget deal to prevent another government shutdown, but the president insists he's getting that wall built. All that said, there's already a section of the U.S.-Mexico border that's grappling with the potential impacts of a wall. The $1.3 trillion omnibus spending bill passed back in March contained funding for 25 miles of wall to be built along Starr County, Texas. And residents and lawmakers alike are starting to worry about the negative environmental impacts the wall would have.
These are floodplains, like these very difficult areas to build.
That's Melissa Del Bosque, a reporting fellow with the nonprofit newsroom Type Investigations.
Much of our border with Mexico is geographically very rugged. I mean, we have a lot of high cliffs. Here in Texas, it's all river. It's the Rio Grande. So this specific section that I focused on in my story that I did for the Texas Monthly is one of the hardest sections to build on because it's all sandy banks. There's no flood levee, and it's in a floodplain.
Across the conservative state of Texas, many have come out to support the border wall, including Republican Senators Ted Cruz and John Cornyn.
I think the American people believe there is a crisis at the border. It's a humanitarian crisis.
The American people want the border secured. It's the right thing to do.
But it's a different story along the border. There's only one Republican in the House who represents a district along the border, Republican Will Hurd. He's voted with Democrats multiple times to fund the government without money allocated for the wall.
Well, I think building a concrete structure, sea to shining sea, is the most expensive and least effective way to do border security.
Down at the border, the wall isn't just about politics or the debate on immigration. Lawmakers and residents are also concerned about what a wall could mean for their homes, their land, the impact on the environment, and possibly even their livelihoods. One of those lawmakers is Roland Gutierrez, a state legislator representing San Antonio in the Texas House of Representatives.
I can tell you the folks in Starr County, they don't want this wall. We had folks from CBP and the Army Corps go and talk to these folks in various town hall meetings. The federal government says, hey, just trust us. Well, those are the same people that told the folks in Nogales, Arizona, just trust us. And they caused over $8 million in property damage. And so just trust us isn't good enough.
Nogales, Arizona. Back in 2008, the sister cities of Nogales in the U.S. and Mexico were divided by a section of wall that was approved under the George W. Bush administration in 2006.
It's in a floodplain area, these two cities. And so during their normal monsoon season, all of a sudden, they had this sort of catastrophic flooding in downtown Nogales on both sides of the fence. But it was much, much worse on the Mexican side. The downtown city streets were inundated. A couple of men died. $8 million worth of damage to the Mexican city of Nogales. And what the engineers found was that it was actually the border fence that had caused so much of the damage. It clogs up with debris. They had a lot of runoff that went up against the fence and brush and trash and all this stuff. So the fence then becomes a dam. It just becomes a solid structure and the water just builds up against it.
Now, as the debate over the wall continues to play out on the national stage, residents of border towns in Starr County fear they could end up facing similar devastation to Nogales.
My name is Naida Alvarez, and I live in a small community called La Rosita in Texas. The wall's going to be about 5 feet in back of my window, in the back of the house, based on the map that they showed me. And mind you, when we had a major flood 8 years ago, it went up to the highest riverbank that was at the level where my house is. I'm not just going to lose a piece of land. I'm going to lose my heritage, my home. My home is on the property, literally about 200 feet from riverfront. I've called the Army Corps of Engineers, and you know what their response was? Oh, we'll squeeze it in there. Yet you ask them questions, and they say, well, we don't know yet. Yet you want me to sign a paper that you don't know what it is yet?
So, I mean, they've pretty much got things streamlined at this point where they're going to build it no matter what.
Roland Gutierrez doesn't accept that.
Do you expect federal agencies to be truthful with the American people? And if they're not, then we have a big problem in this country. And so I filed HB 990 specifically so that state agencies could keep federal agencies honest. And so we've asked the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, as well as the Texas Water Development Board, to do their own studies, create findings and recommendations to not just the governor, the lieutenant governor, and the chief of the Speaker of the House, but also recommendations to the Attorney General, up to including filing a lawsuit against the federal government.
Gutierrez is realistic about the chances of his legislation making headway in a Republican-controlled state government.
I'm not going to give up this fight, and I'm not going to give up this fight if I don't get a hearing on this bill. I will seek to find some bill to put an amendment on and make people vote on this very important subject matter that doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat.
In the meantime, construction in Starr County is set to begin in September, and the president continues to demand action on what he says is a national emergency.
You know, all this is based on a crisis that doesn't exist. If there was a crisis, I wouldn't let my grandkids out and play outside my house. You know, we go fishing, we do all that stuff by the river, and I would not expose them children to anything that would hurt them. I just don't see a crisis. You know, somebody's crying wolf, and it's not there.
We reached out to Customs and Border Protection for a comment, but as of the airing of this report, we haven't heard back. We did receive a comment from Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar, who represents Starr County in Congress. Cuellar said, "My office makes it a top priority to make sure that we do everything we can to eliminate potential dangers posed to local communities. I will continue to fight against the construction of a border wall."
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Today is Galentine's Day. which, as you of course know, is a holiday that comes to us from the beloved sitcom Parks and Recreation.
What's Galentine's Day? Oh, it's only the best day of the year. Every February 13th, my lady friends and I leave our husbands and our boyfriends at home and we just come and kick it breakfast style.
The premise is simple. It's all about celebrating female friendships. Now, I'm a fan of Parks and Rec, but I have to confess, I did not know much about Galentine's Day before today. So I'm looking forward to getting educated by two writers who have thought a lot about the power that comes from women supporting other women. Kayleen Schaefer is the author of Text Me When You Get Home, The Evolution and Triumph of Modern Female Friendship. Aminatou Sow is the co-host of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend and the co-author of a forthcoming book on friendship called Big Friendship. Kayleen Aminatou, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Thank you for having me.
So, Kayleen, first I want to start with you. And if you could talk about why you felt it was important to document the importance of female friendships.
I wanted to write this book because I looked around at my own life and I looked at the women I knew and I saw how important their friendships were to them and how much they treated their friendships. They put them on the same level as they did their relationships with their romantic partners or their families. And I wanted to help validate that because everything we heard was, oh, you're this friendship is a side relationship. It shouldn't be as important as the other relationships in your life. But that wasn't the way we were living. And I think that women need that recognized.
I wonder as well if you're trying to push back against some kind of stereotypes. Because if you look at, you know, the canon of you know, historical literature, before women started to write more novels, you weren't really getting many great examples of female friendship in the canon.
No, absolutely. I mean, before women started telling their own stories, it was all catfights, women can't get along, women ditch each other when they find a romantic partner. You know, it was just nothing but women can't be friends. And so I did want to push back against that because all the women who were friends were saying, I just don't think that's true. I don't catfight with my friends. You know, I don't throw pond scum in their face.
I mean, Aminatou, you're writing a book along with your podcast co-host, the co-host of Call Your Girlfriend. It's a book about friendship. Do those kind of stereotypes, do they dog you at all when you're trying to maintain real friendships with your female friends?
I think, you know, that a lot of those stereotypes are actually, I don't think so. I know so. Those stereotypes are actually very sexist. All human relationships are fraught. And if you are not fighting for your relationships, you're probably not doing it right anyway. Hmm. You know, I think that what is always really interesting is that we always categorize the things that women do, especially young women, as very frivolous. And so this idea that, you know, like being friends with other women is supposed to be very easy and it's supposed to be this kind of easygoing activity that you're all engaged in until you get married or until you have something better going on. Is that's also incredibly sexist. Friendship for, I would say, the majority of women that I know is, it is a central relationship that people have. It is not a temporary bond. Mm-hmm. It's not something that is just a way station on the way to like some heterosexual like idea of what happiness is. The idea that you can have close, intimate friendships with people and that you can share platonic love with them, that is not a gendered idea.
Do you feel at all, I mean, at least maybe in recent years, that these stereotypes and lack of role models in the media, is it starting to change at least a bit?
I think that for women like us who make this kind of media, we are, you know, like we know what's going on and we really understand that kind of the dangerous position that a lot of those stereotypes put us in. But I do think that in doing this work, we are also, you know, there are also a lot of stereotypes that get propped up. Just that this idea that, you know, like women should also always be in harmony with each other or that it's always fun. Like, you know, female relationships, like all relationships are complicated. It doesn't mean that women are difficult people for having complicated relationships. I also think that we erase a lot of narratives around like women who do not share platonic love and are in fact in love with each other when we call everyone girlfriends or we reduce it to just this idea that we, you know, that everything is platonic. And so I think that things are changing. I don't believe that they're changing fast enough. And I also think that, you know, it's worth like really interrogating like what we mean when we say female friendship and who are the people at the center of those bonds.
Someone the other day asked me, like, oh, is Galentine's becoming too commercialized? Like, is it just this Hallmark holiday already? And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, I don't even think the majority of the country knows that Galentine's Day isn't just a replacement for Valentine's Day. And they think, like, oh, it's just this man-hating holiday. And, like, it's no, it's a whole separate day where women are celebrating their bonds. It's like, we don't even have that awareness yet. And so I think, you know, as women are stepping forward and telling their stories and telling about what their friendships mean to them, the more we hear about that, the more iterations of that we will get, and the better, because then it becomes released from these stereotypes that they're all nice or that they're all fraught. You know, we just need to hear many, many different versions of how women are relating to each other. You know, when I was writing Text Me When You Get Home, I spent so much of my time trying to explain to men, like, no, I'm just saying women's relationships with each other are as important as their relationships with you. It was exhausting. I was like, I just don't understand why this idea is so threatening. I'm not trying to say they're more important. I just want to put them on the same level.
Right. But, you know, the idea that they're threatening, I think, is like two things, right? Is that one, there is just this like lavender panic that goes through everything where people are, you know, it's just like, oh, you guys are just hanging out without us. What's going on here?
Right.
But I also think that this having, you know, like women, obviously, like what is going on is that women get to enjoy like a diversity and a complexity of relationships that a lot of, I would say, like cis straight young men do not, for example. And so instead of looking at the relationships that women have and being threatened by them, I think that the mandate is actually for like men to step up and to start having these kinds of connections like across across the board, like whether they're with women, whether they're with men or with anybody else.
For sure. I actually heard from a lot of guys after they read the book and they said, wow, like I don't have friendships like that. I'm jealous. I wish I did. And they it opened their eyes a lot to what could be possible.
I've been speaking with the author of Text Me When You Get Home, Kaylene Schaefer, along with Aminatou Sow, the co-host of the Call Your Girlfriend podcast. It's been great speaking with both of you. Thank you.
Thank you
so much. Happy Galentine's.
Happy Galentine's.
And I hope that you get to start Galentine's Day soon. So maybe that's your homework.
Hi, this is Rachel calling from Salem, Massachusetts. My BFF and I live in different states, leading dramatically different lives. We've been together since middle school. Our similarities affirm our connection, and our differences balance us. She's my rock and my angel.
It's Catherine from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. My best friend Fran and I have been through more than we care to admit to, including a combined total of 8 marriages and too many relationships. We know that even though the men we picked as partners may not have always worked out, she and I will be together through more thick and more thin.
My name is Angela from Newport Richey. My female best friend was named properly by her mother. She is named Joy. Joy is the person I can tell the good and the bad and the ugly, and she will fiercely protect and direct me when necessary, whether I like it or not.
Happy Galentine's, everyone. That's it for us today. Remember, you can find us on Facebook. Leave a comment there about female friendship or anything else you want to share. We are all ears. And, of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Arun Roth, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.